Introduction to Shakespeare's Comedies. Begin Part 1 of 2. Nullum est iam dictum quod non dictum fit prius. Nothing is said now which hasn't been said before. Terence, Prologue to Eunuchus. Section. Shakespeare's Greek and Roman comic predecessors. Samuel Johnson writes in his Preface to Shakespeare that Shakespeare crafted his plays as mixed genre productions, created from life's, quote-unquote, chaos of mingled purposes and casualties. With regard to any purer notions of genre, he tells us that this great playwright was most comfortable when writing comedies because they suited his generous imagination and character best. Johnson says of Shakespeare that, quote-unquote, his tragedy seems to be skill, his comedy to be instinct. Whatever the value of the above critical assessment, Shakespeare, in writing at least some of his comic plays, seems to have worked from ancient models, as when he transformed Plautus's mistaken identity play, Menaechmi, spelled M-E-N-A-E-C-H-M-I, into the comedy of errors. For that reason, we should discuss ancient comedy briefly for the insight its themes and structure can provide. It's customary to distinguish between Greek old comedy like that of Aristophanes, circa 456 to 386 BCE, and the Greek new comedy of Menander, circa 342 to 291 BCE, and other playwrights, such as Menander's later Roman followers Plautus, circa 254 to 184 BCE, and Terence, circa 195 to 159 BCE. Subsection: Greek Old Comedy. If you've ever read or seen a comedy by the Athenian playwright Aristophanes, such as The Clouds, Lysistrata, The Birds, and so forth, you know that it's rough stuff, mainly topical or time-bound satire about famous politicians and philosophers. The Clouds, for example, is about Socrates as proprietor of the so-called thinkery, where all sorts of wildly improbable notions are propagated for the benefit of fools. Outrageous body humor is the essence of such plays, and they can pack a political wallop as well. In Lysistrata, Greek women withhold sexual favors from men until they agree to put an end to the ruinous Peloponnesian War. On the whole, in old comedy, the characters are ridiculous, vain, and shallow. A main item of interest is the perennial quality of human folly, selfishness, and vice. This topic is important in new comedy as well, but old comedy's harsh treatment of human follies stands out. Subsection: Greek and Roman New Comedy. The Greek comic playwright Menander and his later Roman followers Plautus and Terence offer a different brand of comic play. The emphasis is on domestic matters rather than broad political issues. Love, or at least sexual desire treated sympathetically, is central to the action, and there's also some concern for the relationship between the older generation and the younger, particularly between a father and his son, as well as interest in relations between people of different status, such as masters and their clever slaves. Still, there's plenty of fun at the expense of fools, dupes, lovers too old for the mate they desire, and so forth. As is often noted, stock characters are the order of the day in new comedy. We don't look to its characters for deep interiority or subjectivity any more than we would have expected those qualities in Aristophanes' old comedy. New comedy is also morally expansive. The characters who win out tend to be the ones the playwright supposes the audience will like. In comedy, sympathy trumps propriety. The popularity of comic mix-ups and disguises suggests that identities are more interchangeable than anyone had thought. Depending on the circumstances, of course, that could be a good thing or a bad thing. While blessing the individual's desire for happiness in the face of the many obstacles life throws in the way of that state, New Comedy makes no extraordinary claims for the individual's uniqueness or for the special personal dignity that tragic plays usually involve. New Comedy's conception of personhood, of the self, as we would say, requires no grand forays into the depths of human nature. On comedy's terms, that would almost certainly be a waste of intellectual and emotional energy, a Hamlet-like interiority, an incredibly complex, even tortured inner self, would certainly not help a character achieve sustainable happiness. In New Comedy particularly, the world, or fate, or whatever term seems appropriate, is well disposed towards certain characters, and this fundamental disposition on the world's part largely paves the way to individual, marital, and collective happiness. Subsection: The Structure of Tarentian Drama. The Roman poet and critic Horace, in his treatise Ars Poetica, circa 15 BCE, writes, quote unquote, "Let a play which would be inquired after be neither shorter nor longer than the fifth act." But it's commonly said that the structure of the New Comedy comes to us mainly from Aelius Donatus, who anchored his principles to the work of Terence. Donatus, a mid-fourth century Common Era grammarian and rhetoric teacher, wrote commentaries on Terence's plays titled Commentum Terenti, Publii Terentii Comoediae Sex. Letter A. First comes the prologue, which may offer background and context for better understanding the story that will be staged. Letter B. Next comes the protasis, spelled P-R-O-T-A-S-I-S, in which the basic characters and situation are established. This stage corresponds roughly to the first act of a modern five-act play. There will also be some destabilizing incident that generates conflict. Any form of literature requires conflict. Letter C. Third comes the epitasis, spelled E-P-I-T-A-S-I-S, in which events and characters are interwoven and become more complicated. This stage corresponds roughly to the second and third acts of a five-act play. Letter D. Fourth comes the catastasis, spelled C-A-T-A-S-T-A-S-I-S, in which the plot is about to reach its high point, or in fact reaches that high point, and the action seems to be fully wound up. This term can be used to mean climax. This stage or point may occur around the end of the third act or in the fourth act, again, if we are thinking about five-act plays. Incidentally, Julius Caesar Scaliger is responsible for the post-classical term catastasis. Letter E. Last comes the final action, the catastrophe, which in comedy is a happy ending. Errors and deceptions are discovered, misunderstandings and murky motives are clarified, situations and identities firm up, and so forth. Society is in good order and people are free to be happy again. This stage will generally occur in the fifth act of a five-act play. Section: Features and Concerns of Shakespearean Comedy. Subsection: Love and Marriage. Shakespearean comedy's central subject is, of course, love. The aim of this comedy is also profoundly social and strongly oriented towards marriage as the key social institution. From a traditionalist standpoint, marriage is the guarantor of a society, enabling it to thrive materially and transmit forward its customs and values. But there are many kinds of love and many qualities of marriage. What kind of love, then, are we dealing with? What kind of relationships might develop and how? What obstacles are quickly set in the way, by whom, and in the name of what value or purpose? By what means are they overcome? These are some of the basic questions we may want to ask when studying a comic play. Of course, there must be obstacles if there's to be any drama at all. Desire cannot simply be granted its object. It is subject to deferral and delay before, in most cases at least, it achieves satisfaction. So the love quest itself, its frustrations, failures, overcomings, and triumphs will be another central matter to follow. Now consider love in its purely conventional societal value dimension. In this sense, married love is a societal good because couples beget children who perpetuate a society's values and help to maintain that society's material prosperity. Within this conventional context, love is basically a set of property relations. Of course, many of Shakespeare's couples are in tension with the purely conventional property-based dimension of love. The societal aim may be conventional marriage, but based on the couple's reasons for entering into such a marriage, a number of things can happen once this formal institutional event takes place. To give shape to the range of possibilities, we can set forth the following three marriage types, the first of which is rare, a second that constitutes the majority of marriages, and a third that establishes a very inclusive social standard. Number one, the rarest and most fulfilling kind of marriage is the one that begins as, or develops into, an ideal romantic union. This is a marriage in which both partners genuinely love and are attracted to each other. They're soulmates, as we would say today. Number two, the most widespread model is the conventional marriage. At minimum, this kind of union allows a given couple to live together as stable, respectable members of their society. It is available even to people of humble social status, but in Shakespeare it often involves middle to upper class and even noble or royal marriages entered into for dynastic and financial reasons. This broadly defined sort of marriage may or may not involve or strive towards ideal romantic love. In many cases, the couple will be cordial, though not passionate. Number three. The third kind of union is a special case of the conventional marriage, and it generally brings together couples in less than ideal circumstances. Such marriages are sometimes contracted on compulsion or owing to desperation, and the couple in question may not even like each other, let alone feel genuine love. In some cases, little more than a cover for naked sexual passion, i.e. lust, may be sought. As St. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 7:9, it is better to marry than to burn, quote unquote. That's from the 1599 Geneva Bible, BibleGateway.com. Marriage, that is, legitimizes sexual relations, while fornication is merely sin. Examples of the above marriage types would be useful, so let's consider the following. Subsection. First type. Ideal romantic marriages. As for type 1, ideal romantic couplings, Rosalind and Orlando in As You Like It seem like excellent candidates, especially if we allow them a little more time after their respective plays' conclusions. A play isn't a Jane Austen novel, after all, so a playwright must be content to sketch or outline an ideal union, not a fully developed married life. Then, too, Beatrice and Benedick in Much Ado About Nothing, with their razor-sharp, exquisitely timed barbs and personal history with each other, seem like a perfectly matched pair. Absolute domestic harmony isn't everything. They also make a fine contrast with Claudio and Hero, the inexperienced, rather conventional couple who serve as their foils. Subsection, second type. Conventional marriages and matches of uncertain quality. As for the second, perfectly respectable, middling sort of union, we might name the two Merry Wives of Windsor in the play by that name. Mistress Page and Mistress Ford are both respectable, upper middle class, and slightly sassy women married to respectable men of the same class. No Romeos and Juliets here. Just two pairs of happy, financially secure citizens living their best lives together. And as a bonus, the wives get to enjoy duping their rascally suitor, Sir John Falstaff. Excessive jealousy afflicts Master Ford, but once that's dealt with, all's well in Windsor. The page's daughter, Anne, rebels against her parents' wishes to marry the man she loves, Fenton, and in the end, we're left to guess whether she will follow in her mother's footsteps in her marriage, or achieve one of those rarest of things, a perfectly romantic, ideal union. Somehow, given the parents' mild reaction and the play's general ambience, something in between seems most likely. In many of Shakespeare's plays, this conventional conception of marriage satisfies society's needs just fine, and the individual couples seem to be pretty happy with their arrangement too. Much of comedy deals with the process of achieving adequation or balance between broad social imperatives and individuals' desires, and pleasantly conventional marriages work well in this regard. Some conventional Shakespearean marriages straddle the happiness divide, and the playwright may be challenging us to decide for ourselves what sort of union we see developing. One such is the marriage of Petruchio and Caterina, also known as Kate, in The Taming of the Shrew. Will these two live together as a conventionally happy couple, with Kate the Shrew, so-called, having been duly tamed and Petruchio playing the now mild husband? Or will they achieve a more truly romantic partnership? Will they continue their struggle for dominance and end up unhappy, or even happy thereby? The answer probably depends on how we interpret Kate's seemingly obedient speech towards the play's end. Another example of a conventional marriage whose parameters are left somewhat open is the union between Portia and Bassanio in The Merchant of Venice. Do the two characters in question have the necessary depth to qualify as anything more than rather shallow semi-aristocrats? The question arises thanks to the sometimes glib, sometimes excessive religious and friendship-based rhetoric that passes for currency in the Christian character circle. Will Portia and Bassanio develop into an ideal couple? It seems a reasonable thing to conjecture, but who can say? Love's Labour's Lost, too, with its several potentially ideal matchups, offers a difficult romantic landscape, one strewn with formal conventional obstacles that the play's conclusion doesn't resolve. Sure, the play is about love, but it is so in a manner that leads us towards a meditation on the ways in which courtship can lead its practitioners into a thicket of human expectations and emotions. There's a technical side, including mastery of rhetoric and pageantry, especially for lovers of high status, to courtship that the King of Navarre, Baron and Company, find requires a great deal of effort. Subsection, third type, marriages based on desperation, compulsion, or lust. In As You Like It, Touchstone the witty courtier and Audrey the simple shepherdess would never be mistaken for an ideal match. Their union is mainly about legitimizing Touchstone's sexual needs and probably Audrey's as well. But that's enough. Conventional marriage will cover them both, though few people would want to bet on Touchstone remaining faithful to Audrey for long. An even less happy union is the one forced upon the rascally wit Lucio in Measure for Measure. The Duke forces him to marry Kate Keepdown, apparently a prostitute he got pregnant a while back. Lucio complains vociferously, but the Duke isn't interested in his whining. This marriage is more of a punishment for Lucio than anything else, but it should still fulfill society's basic imperative of moral respectability, or at least the appearance of such, and provide for the child's upbringing. Also in Measure for Measure, the severe hypocrite Angelo must marry Mariana, a former lover whom he jilted over money. The Duke demands that he marry this woman who still inexplicably actually loves him. As the French say, the heart has reasons that reason doesn't know. Shakespeare is aware that quite often one partner in a marriage simply loves the other more. Love is not always, and perhaps is only rarely ever, divided evenly between two people. Subsection, those who remain beyond or outside the marriage circle. Another question mark consists of those who remain outsiders to the institution of marriage in Shakespeare. Some remain beyond the circle of marriage due to their peculiar temperament. Examples of this would be the melancholy Monsieur Jacques in As You Like It and Feste the Wry Clown in Twelfth Night. Both of these characters are quintessential observers, not steady participants in the world's goings-on. It would not suit them to marry. It's just as well. As Dr. Johnson says, Shakespeare is capable of dealing with many aspects of life, not just love. With due apologies to the Beatles, love isn't always all you need. There are also a limited number of characters who seem same-sex oriented in today's terms. Most particularly, there's Antonio in Twelfth Night and Antonio in The Merchant of Venice. The first's passion-tinged amicitia, or friendship, for Viola's brother Sebastian is bound to remain unrequited. And the same is true of the second Antonio's obvious love for Bassanio, who marries the lovely heiress Portia after nearly costing his older male friend his life over that huge loan from Shylock. Section: Reflections on Conventionality and the Range of Acceptable Marriages in Shakespearean Comedy. We could go on with these explorations, but there's no need. We can easily infer Shakespeare's reason for exploring in his comedies the phenomenon of conventionality in life, both its strengths and its limitations. Conventionality protects people and allows them to flourish, but it may also limit them, preventing their growth into fully developed human beings. To a certain extent, conventionality functions as a means whereby the individual can adjust his or her desires to suit the community, and, at least to some small extent, the obverse can also happen, so that a workable equilibrium is achieved. Conventionality and normativity can be stultifying, but they're also productive sites of contestation. All in all, Shakespeare seems to view the power of convention as a kind of social magic akin to art and artifice. We won't find this thoughtful playwright simply dismissing conventions or norms in a fit of impatience. He acknowledges the pull of natural impulses, but does not suggest that they must always be indulged any more than they can be persistently and totally denied. Artifice, which includes conventions like marriage, is always in tension with raw human nature. The institution of marriage, as we said, can accommodate all sorts of arrangements, some of which conduce to happiness more than others, some less so. In our time, we are impatient with anything short of a marriage that seeks the ideal of true love. Marriages that seem to be all about money or appearances or dynastic or familial concerns disappoint or even unsettle us. They all seem to entail an unacceptable degree of settling rather than an attempt to live a full life. None of this is meant to depress readers and make them think that there's nothing but settling in Shakespeare's comic plays. Far from it. Shakespeare's warrant for representing the more ideal kind of love seems to have been at least an indirect knowledge of ancient Greek romance novels such as Achilles Tatius's Leucippe and Clitophon, Caraton's Chaereas and Calliroe, and Longus's Daphnis and Chloe. These tales were fueled by the adventures of passionate lovers, and we can find their influence filtered through many texts that Shakespeare would have known. Sir Philip Sidney's prose romance, The Countess of Pembroke's Arcadia, is one text that underscores such influences, and so are medieval collections of novelle, such as Boccaccio's Decameron and Matteo Bandello's collection as translated by François de Belleforest, and thence Englished by William Painter, spelled Payenter, as The Palace of Pleasure. Shakespeare used this kind of material for his comedies and tragedies alike. Still, to sum up this first part of the guide on comedy, modern readers may find themselves surprised at just how accommodating Shakespeare can be when it comes to the workable varieties of marriage. At times, it seems that almost any kind will serve society's needs. A marriage may range on a sliding scale, frankly, from near heaven on earth to a species of restitution, and thence to what Lucio in Measure for Measure calls, quote-unquote, hanging, pressing, and whipping. Yet, it may still suit society's ends. So this is something to keep in mind. What kind of marriages are the various characters getting themselves into, and whose needs do those marriages serve? End part one of two. Thanks for listening. This audio lecture was recorded on Saturday, October 4th, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For Shakespeare quotations, I have relied on the Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition 4-volume genre-based format.